ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, and welcome to ID, the Future. My name is Emily Reeves, and today I'll be speaking with Dr. Casey Luskin, Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. We're going to be talking about his recent paper in the Journal of Religions that compares 8 different models of human origins. Human origins may be the area where mainstream science and faith appear to be most at odds, but are they? What are some of the various ways that contemporary scholars have reconciled these differences? In today's podcast, we'll get answers to these questions and more. Welcome, Casey, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Emily, or should I say Dr. Reeves? It's great to be on the show with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a while since we've done one of these together.
Yes, it's been a while.
Yeah. So Casey, the title of your paper is Comparing Contemporary Evangelical Models Regarding Human Origins. Can you tell us just a little bit about that title, what your paper's about, and who did you write it for?
Yeah. So the purpose of the paper is to look at various attempts to sort of synthesize science and religion in the area of human origins and compare those models, sort of looking at the strengths and the weaknesses of different models that are out there. And its purpose is really to help people sort through all the different models that are out there. I'm aware that there's a lot of different viewpoints and ideas and thoughts that people have had about how to explain human origins in the context of science and faith, specifically, you know, myself speaking as a Christian in terms of traditional Christian theology. And sometimes all these different models can be a little bit confusing for people as they're trying to sort through them. So I really wrote this article for somebody who is interested in the question of human origins, is trying to reconcile science and faith, but is trying to figure out sort of which model is best for them in terms of understanding these issues. And so I really wrote the article for anybody, whatever their viewpoint happens to be. I tried to be somewhat objective and academic about it. This was written for a mainstream academic journal. So I wasn't being too much of an advocate, although certainly I do have my own view as far as which models I think are better. And that probably comes through a little bit in the paper, but I tried to be fairly objective, just reviewing how these various models interface with the scientific evidence, with various theological views, and which ones do better than others, and just sort of comparing them so people can make up their own minds which models they think are best.
I think that's a great objective. And I recall first reading a draft of this paper before it was published earlier this year. And my husband Daniel and I, we were on a long 2-hour drive, but we didn't really notice the time or the traffic because we were so taken with this paper. And we were struck, I think, by how concise and organized and how it really does help one to think through both the theological issues as well as some of these scientific ones.
Well, I really appreciated the feedback from you and Daniel, who many of our listeners will know, Daniel Reeves here at Discovery. It was really helpful to get feedback from my colleagues because this is a complex issue, and I wanted to make sure I was being fair to the different views and also trying to help people think it through. I should add that, you know, this paper really is very far afield from intelligent design. I published it in this journal called Religions, which is having a special issue on science and faith. And I wanted to explore this issue from a science-faith standpoint because it's something that I'm interested in personally as a Christian. But of course, I recognize that this is not necessarily intelligent design. Intelligent design does not require you to have a Christian view of human origins. I know folks in the ID community who are not Christians and hold very much, you know, very different kinds of views on human origins from maybe what I might believe, but yet they still see evidence for design in nature. So this paper really is not about intelligent design. I should just make that clear. It's definitely more in the tradition of looking at science and faith and how we can fit those two together.
Yeah, and you're so right. So let's go ahead and maybe you can introduce us to, I don't know if you want to do all 8 of the models or just a few of them that your paper evaluates.
Sure. I mean, I'm not necessarily going to go through all the models in detail right now. I think that's better. If you really want to do that, download the paper. It's open access. It's free. You can get it at the Religions Journal, which is published by MDPI, or we also have it linked from evolutionnews.org. And certainly we'll link to it from the podcast as well. But the 8 different models we looked at are, number 1, the classic theistic evolution or evolutionary creationism model, which is often associated with groups like BioLogos and also others like Dennis Lamoureux and some, you know, well-known theistic evolution folks. The second model would be the Homo Divinus model, which was initially advocated by the theologian John Stott, but more recently by the prominent theistic evolutionist biologist Dennis Alexander of the Faraday Institute. And the third model that I looked at is the genealogical Adam and Eve model, which is developed by computational biologist and scholar Joshua Swamidas, who is a professor at the University of Washington in St. Louis. A lot of folks have probably heard about this model because Professor Swamidas has done a lot of YouTube interviews and chats about this, and it's certainly gotten a lot of attention in the last few years. It's an interesting model. The fourth one is another model people might have heard of. It was developed by the famous Christian philosopher William Lane Craig, and I call this the Homo Heidelbergensis model. It's the model that he puts forth in his 2021 book, In Quest of the Historical Adam. And so for folks who have read that book, this is basically looking at the model that he puts forth in that book. The fifth model is what I call the unique origins design model, which was developed by two intelligent design proponents. That would be biologist Ann Gager and mathematician Ola Hoster, who many of our listeners might recall did a research project, a scientific research project on human origins a few years ago. They published their results in the journal Biocomplexity, which basically found that the human species could have come from an initial pair of two, and we could still explain all of modern day human genetic diversity, even if we only came from an initial pair of two individuals. The sixth model is the classical old Earth creationist model, which is advocated by some well-known scientists at Reasons to Believe, such as Fazel Rana and Hugh Ross. The seventh model is the classical young Earth creationist model, which is probably very well known to folks, whether you agree or disagree with it. I think that the young Earth creationist model is certainly the sort of the traditional model of Adam and Eve in many ways. The idea that, you know, they were created just a few thousand years ago, that they were specially and miraculously created by God, that they're the sole progenitors of all humanity. And certainly many of the other models hold various aspects of that model as well, but the young Earth creationist model is probably very well known to folks. It's advocated by groups such as the Institute for Creation Research and Answers in Genesis. And then an eighth model is sort of an interesting model. I call it the old Earth, recent humans hybrid model. It's not quite as well known, and it's not advocated by a lot of people, but it is out there, so I thought it worth including. It's basically the idea that the Earth might be old, but humans might have been created very recently. And there are some folks out there that hold to that view. So I'm not going to get into too much detail about all these models, but I'll just say this. Four of the models are evolutionary models, and four of the models are what I call non-evolutionary models. So the four evolutionary models are the first ones I mentioned. The classic theistic evolution model, the Homo divinus model, the genealogical Adam and Eve model, and the Homo Heidelbergensis model. Each of those models essentially proposes that humans evolved from a common ancestor they shared with apes. Now, some of those models would explicitly deny a historical Adam and Eve. I'm thinking of like the classical theistic evolution model, really denies that there ever was sort of an initial pair that all humanity came from. And they just basically take the standard evolutionary view and say, this is the way that God did it. But there's no traditional theology incorporated into that model. The Homo divinus model, it will believe in it sort of an Adam and Eve, but Adam and Eve are not necessarily the traditional Adam and Eve. They're just, you know, two hominids and a much larger population that evolved from a common ancestor with apes. And God just sort of one day said, okay, you two there, you are Adam and Eve. And they're not necessarily the progenitors of the rest of humanity. They might have some sort of federal headship, authority over humanity, but they're not like, you know, traditionally the Genesis says that Eve was the mother of all the living. They would not view Adam and Eve like that. The genealogical Adam and Eve is interesting. It certainly believes that all humans that have ever lived are descended from a common ancestor that we share with apes and evolved from that common ancestor. So certainly evolution is part and parcel of the genealogical Adam and Eve model. But what it says is that at some point, God specially created two individuals, Adam and Eve, so they would have been miraculously created, or at least it allows for this miraculous creation of Adam and Eve. And those two individuals and their offspring then might have interbred with this much larger population of hominids that fully evolved from a common ancestor with apes. So it's sort of a merging of the standard evolutionary view, but then God specially creates two individuals and their offspring interbreed with that evolved population of hominids. And we are the product of that marriage between Adam and Eve's progeny and this basically standard evolutionary evolved population of hominids. And then the Homo heidelbergensis model says that, yes, humanity did evolve from a common ancestor that we share with apes, but at some point we went through a bottleneck of two individuals. And those two individuals would have been like, essentially, they would have been Adam and Eve. Now, God did not necessarily specially create them, but at least we're descended from just that that initial pair that God, you know, essentially deemed would be the first people who were made in the image of God, who would have been given souls, et cetera. And we are descended, all humanity is descended from just that initial pair. And then the other four models are the non-evolutionary models. The first one, the unique origins and design model, would basically say that God created Adam and Eve, potentially, you know, specially and miraculously created them separately from the apes, but that this happened a long time ago, maybe as far back as, say, 1.5 million years ago, or perhaps as recent as 500,000 years ago, maybe even more recently. But the point of this model is to say that if Adam and Eve lived long ago, and they could have been specially created by God, that's fine with this model, and it's not an evolutionary model. So, you know, all humanity would not be descended from a common ancestor with apes under this model. But the idea is that Adam and Eve lived a long time ago, and this is supposed to give enough time for modern day human genetic diversity to just sort of arise naturally. Then again, we got the old earth creationist model that also says that God specially created Adam and Eve, but not necessarily as far back as the unique origins and design model. The unique origins and design model basically says that when God specially created Adam and Eve, that might have been potentially around the same time that the human-like members of the genus Homo first appear in the fossil record. So it could be anywhere, you know, 1 to 1.5 million years ago, maybe less than that, but, you know, something like that. The old earth creationist model, it correlates the timing of the creation of Adam and Eve with the explosive appearance of modern-day human intellectual activity in the archaeological record. And that shows up about 100,000 years ago. And so they would say that the creation of Adam and Eve is aligned very well with when humanity, sort of the evidence of our modern day high intellectual abilities, when that first appears in the archaeological record. And there's a very big, I've heard people call it the culture explosion in the fossil record, when we suddenly get all of these modern human-like activities in the fossil record, sorry, in the archaeological record. And then, of course, the young earth creationist model says that humans were created just a few thousand years ago, maybe 6 to 10,000 years ago. And the old earth recent humans hybrid model says the same thing. It just says that the earth is not necessarily young. There's an old earth, but God waited a long time to create humanity just a few thousand years ago. So those are the eight models, and some of them are evolutionary, some are non-evolutionary.
Yeah, that's a great summary. And for those of our listeners who want to learn more about those, each particular model and the details of that model, definitely you're going to want to check out the paper. There's lots more good stuff in there. So we've covered a few of the key issues that differentiate and distinguish these different models. And you talked a little bit, Casey, about how you separate the first four, I believe, into evolutionary models and the second four into non-evolutionary models. Do you want to talk maybe a little bit more about, maybe let's talk about some particular lines of evidence for your favorite model?
That's fair, sure. So my hope is that if people read the paper, they won't necessarily know what my favorite model is. And I don't know, I've had a number of people email me who read the paper, but I haven't asked anybody yet, oh, could you figure out which one I like? So I'm hoping that they couldn't. You know, it's like
that's a great goal.
Yeah. Like, you know, like you have that professor in college where the professor says, so what do you think I think? And then the class raises their hand and they get it totally wrong. And the professor's like, great, I did my job. You know, like I didn't come off too far one way or the other. That was my goal. And maybe I don't know if I accomplished it perfectly or not, but certainly I do favor the, you know, a non-evolutionary view. I think that the scientific evidence does not support an evolutionary model of human origins. My preferred models, I'm kind of somewhere between the unique origins and design model and the old earth creationist, the classical old earth creationist model. I'm kind of somewhere between those two models. I would say that, you know, that's pretty much where I fall. So,
yeah. And maybe you can tell us just a little bit. I know in the paper, you really go through some of the different, how these models square up with like some of the different traditional theological beliefs. Maybe you can speak to that a little bit for this model.
Sure. So, I mean, we can do a quick rundown. I mean, the traditional theological beliefs that I looked at is, number one, do you even believe in Adam and Eve? Like, you know, this traditional theological view among Jews and Christians and probably Muslims and many other folks out there believe that humanity was initially descended from Adam and Eve, who were specially created by God, that all humanity is descended from these two initial individuals, and that they were real people. So, I mean, right off the bat, the classical evolutionary creationist theistic evolution model, they typically will deny that Adam and Eve even existed. They're not even on the radar screen, essentially, as far as theology, you know, needing them to actually have been real historical people. So that model does not agree with that. Though all the other models believe in historical Adam and Eve. The Homo Divinus model believes in historical Adam and Eve, but it does not believe that Adam and Eve were the progenitors of all humanity or the sole progenitors, nor does it believe that they were specially created by God. The genealogical Adam and Eve model does actually allow that God specially created Adam and Eve, but then it says that we also are descended from this population of hominids that evolved. So in this model, Adam and Eve might be the progenitors of all living humans today, but they have not been the progenitors of all humans that ever lived. And we also have many other progenitors, such as this population of evolved hominids. So it's sort of a mixture there. Some folks might, you know, say, okay, well, is that weird to say that a lot of humanity over the history of the human race has not been descended from Adam and Eve? What are the theological implications of that? I think there's a lot of interesting questions that are raised there. The Homo Heidelbergensis model, it really does not propose, if you look at what William Lane Craig says, you know, specifically about, I think, that model, it really favors the idea that they were not specially created. I mean, I think that he might be open to that, but I think that model does not favor the idea that they were specially created, but that they evolved from a common ancestor shared with apes. In his book, William Lane Craig cites certain lines of evidence like pseudogenes and so forth that he thinks shows that we are descended from a common ancestor with apes. Now, what is sort of more, I think, theologically traditional about this model is it does say that we are all descended from just this initial pair of individuals. They might have descended from a common ancestor with apes ultimately, but at least we're descended from just that pair of two individuals, sort of a bottleneck that the human race went to, and we call that bottleneck Adam and Eve. So the unique origins and design model, as well as the classic old earth creationist model, I mean, they all propose that God specially created Adam and Eve, that they are our sole progenitors, that they were made in the image of God. Really, where they depart from maybe the traditional view is they don't believe that Adam and Eve were created just a few thousand years ago, that they might have been tens of thousands of years ago or 100,000 years ago, maybe even multiple hundreds of thousands of years ago that God made Adam and Eve. And so for some folks who want to have a more recent Adam and Eve, that, you know, these models probably will not appeal. And then the young earth creationist model and also the hybrid model, they adopt all those views. Adam and Eve were real historical people. They were specially created by God, sole progenitors of all humanity, but then they were made just a few thousand years ago. So that sort of fulfills, I think, all of the standard traditional theological views of Adam and Eve are fulfilled in those two models. But do you want me to talk about the science?
Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking, let's go to the science now. I know, and I would recommend for anyone looking at this paper, if you don't have 2 hours to in-depth read it, which I do recommend, but if you just have a few minutes, if nothing else, be sure to check out tables 1, 2, and 3 in the paper, where Casey summarizes how these models interact with what he just talked about, the traditional theological beliefs, as well as how the different models mesh with or do not mesh with the mainstream scientific positions on human origin. So yeah, take it away, Casey.
Yeah, and I don't recommend reading the paper while you're driving. Maybe if you have somebody else driving. I think Daniel was driving that one day.
Yeah, Daniel was driving and I was reading.
Okay, well, that makes me feel a lot better, yeah. But yeah, certainly we can get into the science. I mean, there's so much to talk about here. But as far as the science goes, I mean, I do think that the science does not support an evolutionary view of human origins. And so, I mean, evolutionists will cite various lines of evidence from, you know, say fossil evidence, genetic evidence that they believe shows that humanity is descended from a common ancestor with apes. I would argue that when you dig into the technical literature, you find that evidence is not nearly as strong as it's often claimed to be. For example, with regards to the fossils, we find that it's very well acknowledged in the literature that there is a large and unbridged gap between human-like members of the genus Homo and some of our supposed ancestors, like the ape-like Australopithecines. And so this really causes a problem. You can look at the literature and see people saying that, you know, there had to have been a genetic revolution because no Australopithecine species is obviously transitional, and, you know, calling for a Big Bang model of human origins. So this really, I think, does not support the fossils, at least. I don't think that they have a clear-cut case that humans and our genus Homo are descended from a common ancestor with apes. As for the genetic evidence, I mean, one of the biggest arguments has been that modern-day human genetic diversity is too great for humanity to have ever been sort of arising from just an initial pair, that we had to have risen from a large population of many thousands of individuals. And this happened over, you know, many hundreds of thousands, millions of years to generate all the modern-day human genetic diversity. This is made by some theistic evolutionists, such as Dennis Venema, and others have made these arguments. Well, it turns out that you actually can account for modern-day human genetic diversity and having us arising from just an initial pair of two individuals if Adam and Eve, or as we could call them, lived far enough back. So that really is not a problem for Adam and Eve. And then I actually, when I dug into the literature, I found out that some young Earth creationists have actually had some, you might call it, creative genetics here, where they essentially found a way to say that if there was diversity built in, not just into the genome of Adam and Eve, but also into their gametes, that they could then account for modern day human genetic diversity if Adam and Eve lived only just a few thousand years ago. So it seems like there might be some solutions to this modern day human genetic diversity problem. Whether you believe in a more ancient Adam and Eve, like I would probably favor that view, or whether you believe in a more young Adam and Eve, either way, there seem to be some solutions to this question of how do we explain modern day human genetic diversity. So I don't think that that's a good argument anymore for an evolutionary origin of Adam and Eve, or of humans, I should say. Another line of evidence that we hear sometimes cited is the idea that human and chimps and our ape-like friends that are out there, that our genetics are so similar. We have 99% similar genomes. And this is proof that we share a common ancestor and that we're related through an evolutionary history. Well, we do share a high degree of genetics with chimps, but it's not 99%. The best estimates that I found, and I documented this in the paper, it's probably somewhere between 84 and 96%, although the jury really is still out, because we really don't have, I think, a really good draft of the chimp genome that did not use the human genome as a scaffolding yet. But whatever the actual number is, no percent genetic similarity between human and chimp genomes is going to prove, or I would say, force you to accept an evolutionary origin and a common ancestry for those, you know, for those species, because the similarities could be the result of common design, where we're simply built upon a common blueprint. But then people will come back and say, well, okay, fine, there's certain DNA between humans and chimps that's really similar that does not have any function. So why would you have this common design of, say, all this junk DNA in the human and chimp genomes? Why would God independently put the same useless DNA into the genomes of both humans and chimps? Isn't that better explained by us inheriting all this junk from a common ancestor? And I would say, well, if it was in fact junk, I might be inclined to agree with you. But the data, the trend line is really not going in the direction of the idea that our genomes are largely full of junk. And I talk about some of the data that's come out of the ENCODE project, where, you know, the journal Science had a headline that said that ENCODE project writes eulogy for junk DNA. And other papers as well. There was a paper in the journal Genome Biology and Evolution a couple years ago, which said the days of junk DNA are over, because essentially we're finding mass evidence of functionality for essentially, you know, the vast majority of our genome. Now, of course, there's still many specific examples of DNA elements that we don't know exactly what they're doing yet, but there is good evidence, prima facie evidence, I would say, that it's functional. So I think that really this idea that our genomes are largely full of junk is not so workable anymore. So the last one I'll hit. So people will say, well, fine, maybe a lot of our genome is functional, but we still have these pseudogenes. Pseudogenes and also endogenous retroviruses seem to be very persuasive to our theistic evolutionist friends that humans and apes share a common ancestor. Well, we have the same problem with pseudogenes and endogenous retroviruses that we have for the rest of the junk DNA. And that is that we are discovering more and more evidence of function for those types of DNA as time goes on. And you can read the paper and get all the literature, but I mean, the literature is filled with papers saying, don't use the term pseudogene anymore, or we now think that pseudogenes might actually be functional. And of course, there's still a lot where we haven't discovered specific functions yet, but I think this assumption that pseudogenes are non-functional really does not work very well anymore. And I could tell some stories on this, but we'll just leave it at that for now.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I just recently heard of an example where the region from the pseudogene is sometimes put into the region of the regular gene and providing like more variation, or I don't know, we don't know what it's doing. So
yeah, there are good reasons why we have these things that look like the protein coding version of the gene, but don't yield functional proteins.
Exactly.
And it has to do with gene regulation. Pseudogenes can yield RNA transcripts that might not be able to produce a protein, but those RNA transcripts are involved in regulating the other version of the gene in your genome that does, in fact, produce the protein coding version of the gene. So we have very good functional reasons to understand why we have these things that look like genes, but don't produce proteins. And they're there because they're part of a normal gene regulatory system. Let me give one last example of this. For people who are tempted to say, but come on, like, isn't this well known? Well, people have been so sure that pseudogenes are non-functional. And I tell this story in the paper. Back in the Dover trial, Ken Miller testified about the beta globin pseudogene. He said it's broken. It has molecular errors that render the gene non-functional. And 2 years later, Eugenie Scott participated in this large debate at the Natural History Museum where she said this pseudogene, the beta globin pseudogene, is not going to do diddly. It's just going to sit there and not do a thing. And lo and behold, you know, we waited for the data. They were just assuming it was functional in the absence of evidence. But we waited for the data to come in. And now we know that this pseudogene is, in fact, very important. In fact, a 2021 study found that it is essential for forming human red blood cells. So this pseudogene that, you know, some theistic evolutionist folks like Ken Miller were so confident that they testified in court that this demonstrates that we share common ancestry with apes. And they said it's broken. It now turns out it's essential, according to a scientific paper, for forming human red blood cells. So that tells you to be really cautious about making this argument that pseudogenes are non-functional. There's a lot we don't know, and the more we study them, the more we're finding function.
Yeah, excellent point. And there are so many examples of this in the literature. So to kind of start wrapping this up a little bit, I know you propose a scoring system helping a reader to evaluate these different models. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can talk about that real quick. So I use a scoring system based upon how these models perform on various scientific points, scientific evidence, and also traditional theological views. And I try to ask which ones are doing better. I'm not even sure, to be honest with you, if I like my own scoring system, because I think that, you know, it's a little bit arbitrary and some people are going to weigh some things differently than others. Some people will want to say, well, which models are doing better on the science? That's what they care about. Other people are going to say, well, which models are doing better on the theology? Because that's what they care about. And some people are going to want to look at both. I'm the kind of person that's going to look at both the science and the theology. So that's why I like the unique origins and design model. It actually scored among the highest, or actually it was tied for the highest as far as scoring well with both the science and the theology. But, you know, some of these models don't do so well. The theistic evolution model only gets points for the science. And the young earth creation model, it gets all of the, you know, the theological points, but then on the mainstream scientific points, it really doesn't do so well. So there's a real spectrum of how these different models are doing. You can read the paper to get a feel for it, but really the hope is not necessarily to tell you which model you should adopt, but to help you understand the models and get a better feel for them. So then you can decide which model appeals most to you and which do you think is the best model. That's my hope.
Okay. So to wrap this up now, where do you think this leaves attempts to reconcile science and faith regarding human origins?
Yeah, so look, there have been a lot of models that have been developed over the last few decades for reconciling science and faith on human origins. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of different opinions that are out there. I think what we're seeing is that some models are more successful than others at trying to reconcile science and faith. Some look just at the science, some look just at the theology. Others work on, you know, from looking at both. But I think what's clear is that you don't have to jettison traditional beliefs about Adam and Eve in light of the findings of science. That's my take home from this. Now, of course, some people have different ways of coming to that conclusion, but there is a real rich diversity of models that are out there. And you know, some people don't care about this because they're not even religious. They're not trying to reconcile science and faith. Okay, fine. Well, you know, I still think it's worth looking at this because it's very interesting to see how I think that, you know, it's not as hard as some people might think to reconcile science with sort of a traditional view of the origin of humanity. And again, if you know, download the paper and read it, you can get a feel for this. The paper is available from Religions Journal. We'll also link to it from our podcast interview here. It's open access, so it's free. And you know, if you're driving alone, pull over and read it on the side of the road. If not, take a little, have somebody else when they're driving you around, take a couple hours and read it. And I'd love to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, that's great. I think that there's so much complexity to balancing and harmonizing scientific evidence with scripture that it is really important to just approach these topics of human origins with an open mind and willingness to learn. And Casey did a great job of that in this paper. And so I think really it's a great starting point for understanding these different models and working on this reconciliation between science and scripture. So let's continue, you know, to explore this area and discuss it with curiosity and respect. And I hope all of our listeners will read this paper, share it with family and friends of faith who have questions. Talking about origins raises some of the most important questions in life about our worth, value, and knowing where we came from can provide direction, hope, and emotional well-being. So thank you so much for your time and effort in summarizing these various models, Casey, both in print and now over ID the Future. So with that, we'll conclude this podcast and hope to speak to you guys more in the future. I'm Emily Reeves with ID the Future. Thanks so much for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.